Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Before beginning, I want to acknowledge the horror in Boston at the Boston Marathon that recently occurred. Again, it gives us all pause to think about America, our country, to think about ourselves, and I believe to think about the never-ending task of creating caring community, of standing up for loving relationships, for freedom, for responsibility, for all the values that have made America a really great country. And not to lose sight of that when we are responding to horrific events. Human nature is a mixed bag. We have within us the capacity for violence. I doubt there's anyone who's free of the capacity for hatred. And violence comes following. But we all have the capacity for love. And I have in my mind this image of the videos of the explosion going off in Boston. On the one hand, we have this violent explosion, the product of hatred and violence. And then we have, before the smoke is even cleared, we have rushing in men and women in uniform, civilians, police, to provide instant and life-saving help in an area which many of them had to have realized another bomb might go off again. So it portrays the good and the bad, the dark and the light. And we can't take the goodness for granted. Any civilization can deteriorate rather quickly into a state of chaos and violence and hate. And it's just up to all of us in our personal relationships within ourselves and in any way that we influence the society around us, starting with friends and family and clients and patients, to believe in loving, caring community. On a brighter note, next week is our conference. I had to actually look in my appointment book and confirm that the third empathic therapy conference is going to take place this coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 26th. Well, not this coming. I mean, after this weekend, next week, the next week's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 26th, 27th, 28th in Syracuse. We still have room. And the hotel still has a few rooms at the preferred rate. So if you go to my website or go directly to empathictherapy.org, you can still sign up for the conference. My guest today is Thomas Feuer, F-E-W-E-R. Tom is the founder, director, primary therapist at the New Orleans Counseling Center. What a great name. What a great name to own, the New Orleans Counseling Center. He got his bachelor's at Ohio State and then got a master's degree in counselor education at the University of New Orleans. As some of you know, almost all the teaching I do is in master's degree programs in counseling. I'm very comfortable there. He's a nationally certified counselor. He's worked with clients in outpatient and inpatient and community settings. And he's very interested in cutting to the core of root causes. I became aware of Thomas, as I often become aware of people, through Ginger, who found a really nice, a really good article, feature kind of a blog that he'd written on ADHD in children. And many of you know how proud I am when I have a new guest on whom I haven't met, and the guest tells me, "Oh, Peter, I've been following your work, and I've been inspired by you for decades." Well, not so with Thomas Feuer. He came to these viewpoints on his own and then happened to hear about me and then to make the connection with Ginger. Tom, are you there?
I'm here, Peter.
Good, good. Your connection sounds pretty good. You know, after you and I talked, I spent an hour last night on a special edition, in a sense, not a special edition, but just a special presentation on Coast to Coast. I talked on George Norrie's Coast to Coast, talked to about 6 million people or more last night about hatred. And I thought it was really interesting and valuable that that George Norrie, on his Coast to Coast radio show, which, by the way, is starts at 10 o'clock on the West Coast and then goes across the country for several hours, chose to zero in on hatred rather than on the bombing and then to move on to talk about the bombing. Maybe today we'll get into that. I don't know if you have any particular thoughts about that. It's kind of a new and challenging idea that I didn't bring up with you earlier. I kind of got immersed in it suddenly overnight. Or if you'd like to just start off and tell us about yourself.
Okay, yeah, sure. I am a licensed professional counselor in New Orleans. I'm in private practice, and I also work at a nonprofit agency with children. I have experience as an administrator. I've been a clinical director of an agency that serves about 300 or 400 kids, and that's kind of the place where I got my experience seeing that the medication of them wasn't really being done responsibly and had some harmful effects.
Are you still there, Tom, at that clinic?
No, I've been out. Actually, Saturday will be my one-year anniversary of being away. So,
was it a relief to get away from it?
Very, very much so.
So what did you see there that began to really affect your view of what's going on in psychiatry and mental health?
Well, I saw a lot of kids coming in with very mild symptoms. You know, maybe they had trouble sitting still at school. Maybe they had some minor behavior problems at home. And within, I would say, about 20 minutes of being assessed by a psychiatrist, they had a diagnosis of ADHD or bipolar and were being put on medication. And this is kids as young as 4 and 5 years old. So, and day after day, the same pattern. So it was really the first line of defense was medication. There was not really much investigation of what are the root causes of the attention difficulties. And I saw a lot of times how the pills cause more problems than the benefit that they may have had.
Were you in any way prepared by your training or your earlier experiences to come to grips with an issue like this? Because so many folks just go on and do what they're supposed to do at these clinics.
Not really. Because it's as counselors, I think there's a lot of fear and to speak up against the medical model or the opinion of a psychiatrist. So I think there's a lot of other people that feel this way, but they won't be outspoken about it.
I think it's very striking that you made a decision to think about it. Did you start to confront folks about this at the clinic, or did you just work on this interiorly?
I kind of knew where my supervisor's stance was on the medication and on the diagnosis. So So I had brought it up before, but it quickly got shot down. So the psychiatrist kind of ran the show because people couldn't come into service without a diagnosis. So if the psychiatrist wasn't in control and being able to medicate, the kids wouldn't come in there for the agency wouldn't get any money from the client.
You know, it's this kind of thing that counselors and psychologists and clinical social workers and marriage and family therapists really need to start confronting and protesting and organizing around. I mean, it's really time for the non-medical professionals to get out from under the thumb of my colleagues in psychiatry. I mean, there's no reason why a non-medical person can't perform the diagnosing process. In fact, in my experience, you know, people trained as counselors and clinical social workers are a lot more able to figure out what's going on with the youngster. And then if you need to pin a label on them for the insurance process or whatever else, I mean, anybody's capable of doing that. Anybody's capable of just putting down ADHD or whatever will get the job done with the insurance for the state. I really wish and I hope in the future that there's going to be a shift here. One of the things I've really always wanted to do is empower non-medical people to really start taking over the profession. There's tens of thousands of you, probably hundreds of thousands, and there's 30,000, 40,000 psychiatrists who don't know much about people at all. But that's a bit of an aside for you.
That would be great if that was what happened. I think, I'm as a licensed counselor able to diagnose ADHD and bipolar if I see it. But a lot of times the symptoms being presented, I don't even think really meet the criteria for ADHD or bipolar, and seeing people get put through and medicated anyway, when perhaps like a behavioral intervention therapy, family therapy, would have been a lot more effective. Actually, I've seen the kid as the healthiest person in the family. Many times they're in a dysfunctional situation and responding to that. So then, therefore, they get the label and the medication.
You know, I've often found that the kids, because they don't have the years of living by self-defeating principles, they're still learning principles of living, that they often catch on more quickly than the parents and make changes more quickly than the parents, especially if the parents are trying to help the kids change. It's quite interesting to see that, to see the children so quickly respond in 10 or 15 minutes in a session to what I'm saying. The parents might be shaking their heads and struggling in terms of really looking at what's going on between them. I mean, it's just not uncommon at all for me to have an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old give an analysis of the family dynamics, you know, in terms of, mom, you know, when I get upset and you get mad, and if I get more upset, you act guilty and you get madder, and I just don't know what to do except go to my room and get away from it because it makes me feel terrible, something like that. And the mother's never been able, or the father's never been able to describe it quite so succinctly as that. So it really is a shame that we're diagnosing the, as you said, often the healthiest member of the group.
Yeah, I remember when I worked inpatient, that was one of my first jobs at a psychiatric hospital, and I would see the kid first before having the family session, and I'd talk to them about things that they could change, and the kids would call it out and say, well, you know, if they're not going to change anything, how am I supposed to change the whole family just by myself? So I do think they have a good grasp of what's wrong, but you do need the parent to be invested in in the process. It's not just one, like, you know, the kid has the problem and we have no problem. You're all in it together.
Yeah, and sometimes I'll even tell kids with their parents there, you know, Johnny, you got to take control of your own life. Even if mom and dad keep making these mistakes, you can't just say, look what mom and dad are doing, because we're talking about your life. So I want you to realize that you have in your power to grow up, and mom and dad are going to try, but you got to grow up one way or another to be as in charge of your life as you can be. Otherwise, life's going to suck. So work with us and work with me, work with your parents, and even when they flub, you just keep on growing, because it's for you. This is for you. And kids will get that, and they'll try. But, of course, it's very hard to succeed without parents supporting a youngster. In this clinic, were you able to involve families? A lot of clinics, the families just drop the kids off, Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid kids, and SSI.
Yeah, actually, there was a lot of family involvement, because the majority of the services were delivered in the home. So it was a very intensive program. Kids would get 2 to 3 hours of services per week in their home.
Well, that could have been so marvelous if the kids weren't drugged up. That would have been a really good approach.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because once you go, what I've seen is once you go down the medication road, everything gets filtered through that. Like, if the kid starts acting up, they think, well, the medication's not working, or we need to raise the dose. And instead of looking at other factors, it just seems to be, like, the easiest thing to either blame or to use as the, you know, the fix.
Now, have you found working in private practice? Because one of the things I always encourage non-medical therapists to put at least one foot into a few hours of practice a week, because it's not that hard to start a practice often. You don't need a lot of money to rent an office space from another therapist or a doctor, or to get together with some friends and rent a room in a building. It can be pretty easy to get going. And the freedom is so incredible, your ability to work the way you want compared to a clinic. Have you found that to be so?
100%. I love it. I love private practice. In my practice, though, I only see people 18 and over, due to a lot of the factors we were just talking about. I found so much counterproductive to try to counsel a kid whose parents weren't invested and that was on medication. It just really felt like beating my head against the wall. I mean, and that's not the case. There's a lot of parents out there that are invested, but when they're not, it's really difficult.
Well, you know, one of the things you might try, Tom, is to advertise you know, that you do drug-free treatment of children with their families. Would pass the word around or put it on the internet. There's nothing wrong with your saying you do drug. That's what you offer. They can always go somewhere else for their drugs. That you offer a drug-free approach to children with their families, then you'll attract people to your practice who really do want to change and really do want to help their kids without blaming them with a psychiatric diagnosis and controlling with drugs. Because that's one of the things that I find is because people know what they're coming for, that a lot of the families that come to see me with their kids really do want to work, and it's not a frustrating experience at all.
So that's a good idea. I might have to take that into account and open it up to people who are invested in non-medicated.
Yeah. I screen people on the phone because I don't want somebody feeling like it was a bait and switch where they came to see an ordinary psychiatrist. Now they're finding out they're not going to get their drugs at at 2 o'clock on Thursday or something, you know. So I talk to people in advance about how I work. And you could do the same thing if you got a call from a family. You could talk to them about how you work, and then they're either going to say whoopee, most of them, or they're going to say no. It's really interesting. At our conference, one of the most exciting parts for me, that's next week, April 26th, 7th, and 8th, one of the most exciting things for me is that we're having a pediatrician come who just decided recently to tell his patients that he wasn't going to be prescribing drugs anymore, and they would have a few months to find someone else in regard to the children. And just about everybody, one exception, everybody just thought, all right, let's try that. So I think times are changing out there, and if you make yourself known that you want to help without medicating children, I think you and a lot of folks who are listening who are professionals will find that there's a lot of people looking for that now.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, because the parents don't really know what's going on. That's why they come to us. And when they trust a provider, a doctor, a counselor, they'll usually take their advice. And I think that's why when the doctor prescribes medicine, they feel like, well, he must need it, or they wouldn't be prescribing it. You know, so there's that trust factor there. So I think if more providers did say, maybe it's better to try something different, that they would fall in line if they trusted you.
Sure, and you can always tell them they're free to get psychiatric drugs any place they want. They can get them on the street corner. They can get them from their OBGYN would probably prescribe for their children the way doctors are prescribing now, or maybe the neurosurgeon, let alone the family doctor who's going to, odds are, be quite loose and free and easy with prescribing. So you don't have to feel guilty or bad or irresponsible that alternative is missing, because people can always get psychiatric drugs, and you can say, well, that's just not what I'm going to offer, and I don't advise it, but you're free, of course. And most folks, if they have a better alternative, which is talking and having a relationship with somebody who's helpful, they won't want to turn to the drugs, in my experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that would be the best-case scenario.
But tell us more about your practice and how you work as a counselor with adults.
Okay, well, I work primarily from a depth psychology perspective. Like, I like to look at what is maybe some unconscious issues going on that need to be raised to consciousness and dealt with to bring the person to balance. So I'm not as into like brief solution focus, but try to really, if possible, deal with some of the existential questions like meaning and purpose and authenticity. Like, how do you reach your creative potential as a person? Is really my favorite thing to do with clients.
One of my friends, whom I don't think I've ever met, Mike Mundrot, who I had on the show last week, and who writes a lot on Natural News, just wrote a blog in which he said that the idea that psychiatrists provide mental health care is wholly fallacious, because psychiatrists don't know anything about or address mental health. All they do is try to identify mental illness, and that good therapy involves empowering mental health. That is, good principles of living and, you know, all the things you're talking about. And I thought, gee, I never quite put it that way. So I'm adopting his view now that psychiatrists should not promote themselves as mental health workers. They are mental illness identifiers, which is actually not generally very useful to people.
Go ahead. That's a good point, because I think one way that the medication of any kind can be counterproductive is because when you have a symptom, the symptom comes up for a reason, to tell you that something's wrong inside yourself or your environment. And if you just take a pill that makes you not feel that symptom, it doesn't make that root cause of it go away. It just makes you feel better.
Well, I'd say
it's
feel less. I wouldn't even say feel better, Tom. I'd say just feel less.
Just feel less. And sometimes dealing with these symptoms and these issues is how you grow as a person. So really, you could think of it as you may be stunting your growth process by taking medication that doesn't allow you to feel.
It's very interesting to me that you're a counselor, that you've got the master's degree, because you talk like a really sophisticated therapist. And were these kinds of issues addressed in your counseling program that we're talking about now?
No, we didn't address medication and how to manage, I guess, the therapist relationship to a psychiatrist and how to navigate through that.
Did you address issues like the unconscious?
Actually, not much. I mean, they may have mentioned Freud or Jung a few times, and that was about it. So somehow we've become so ego-focused. Ego counseling rather than we've kind of forgotten that we have an unconscious that is really one of the most powerful forces in our psyche. I'm getting ready to do BEU trainings for counselors and social workers that focus on depth psychology and trying to address these issues that aren't taught in schools. Because I think it puts counselors at a disadvantage to just think of the ego without thinking of the rest of the psyche.
Well, I think that's really true. It's interesting. You know, I don't actively think about the unconscious, but God knows that the most of what is moving us is we're out of touch with, and have to become aware of and look at and understand. And certainly the unconscious, that is experiences we don't recall, feelings we don't identify, have profound effects on us, just absolutely profound. And it's unfortunate that, most counseling programs, they're very good on the, or at least better on the empowerment side of things, but not on the depth therapy kinds of issues that you've gotten interested in. So you're a complicated person. Sounds like you're a lot self-taught, that you just learned and looked at the world and figured stuff out.
And reading books and talking to people.
Yeah. How often do you see your clients?
It's usually once a week to start out, but then sometimes people start to get better. that's usually the goal. Like I tell them, my goal is to fire myself, to give them the tools where they don't need me anymore. So then we may go to every 2 weeks, and just depends. But usually once a week for a good while.
We're going to go to break in about a minute or so. I'm talking with Thomas Feuer, F-E-W-E-R, from the organizer of the New Orleans Counseling Center. I do want to remind people that it'll bring me great joy to have folks come up to me and say, hey, I came to your conference, and that's next week, the 26th, 27th, and 8th. Came to your conference to say hello to you from your radio show. I really would love that experience. Let's go to break. gentlemen, this is Dr. Peter Bregan. My guest is Thomas Feuer, F-E-W-E-R, from the New Orleans Counseling Center. Tom, I imagine people can get in touch with you just with your name, Thomas Feuer, or the Googling New Orleans Counseling Center.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, either way.
One of the things that I thought might be interesting to talk about, since you have a psychodynamic view of life, is this whole issue of hate and violence. Approaching it from an unconscious level, do you think we're all capable of hate and violence?
Yes.
Tell me about that. I have the same conclusion. What are your thoughts about it?
I think it's part of human nature.
Yeah. I tend to think it's almost got an evolutionary role, you know, the tribalism that allowed us to defend ourselves from other tribes and animals and maybe from our ancestors who were diverging from us. I think it's so built into us that I think one of the most important things for people to be able to do is to accept that they've got aggression readily at hand inside of themselves and that they need to recognize it. But it's very hard for people, isn't it?
No, and I think that's one of the reasons for so much divisiveness and kind of why we have like a bipolar country on many issues is because people don't own their shadow side or their darker side. They tend to, we all do this, tend to project it onto someone else, onto another object, and then react to it like it's all out there and not own it.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues, one of the reasons we hate is that we can't bear looking at hating ourselves, feeling inadequate ourselves, being critical of ourselves, feeling like failures. So when we get overwhelmed with that, instead of marshaling our resources, it can be easy to go to hate. Then if we have leaders inflaming that, or if we're in a group, religious group, or an extreme patriotic group, or a class warfare group, I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities for this, then the internal stuff gets blamed. Not that there aren't real issues out there, but we need to approach the real issues out there without being corroded by hatred, which I think does reflect our own sense of ourselves. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense. I think oftentimes we dislike the most in another person the thing that we're the most insecure about in ourselves. Usually those are the things we react to. But also you get into an in-group and an out-group. You know, once you start identifying these people are bad and we're good, and you put that label on it, there's a lot of momentum that gets built in things like we're right and they're wrong, and not being able to, you know, to just find any middle ground.
Yeah, I mean, the degree to which it is such an aspect of ourselves, you know, you think about these sporting events, especially European soccer, where over differences between two cities or two European countries lead to these violent outbursts of behavior, and it's so clearly that can't be the real reason. It's got to be all sorts of internal frustration and anger. One of the things I find that people are so unwilling to identify that they're angry that they need a euphemism like frustrated. So if I realize that and address their frustrations, they're very readily willing, or at least more readily willing, to look that they're frustrated with their husband or wife, they're frustrated with their children, they're frustrated with the world. It's a little easier for them to do that than to just come out and say, God, I'm just struggling with so much anger. I'm afraid I'm getting hateful. I got to learn to control that and handle that. I think that's
bringing back in the ego and the unconscious. And you know, a lot of the work I do with people is trying to make space in their conscious mind for these other parts of themselves that do get disowned, which could be anger, shame, fear, or just things that they've done, that to make space in your conscious mind for the products of the unconscious. And I think this divisiveness that you see projected in the world is a large function of the ego and the unconscious not communicating with each other.
So how do you, in therapy, in practice, help people understand what's been outside their awareness, which is kind of how I view the unconscious, just outside your awareness, inside you, but outside your awareness.
Right, that's why it's unconscious. There's a few different ways. Dreams are always a good way. That's usually the first thing. I try to look at someone's dreams and see if there's any pattern, see if there's any highly emotionally charged dreams. Sometimes people get woken up from their dreams because they're so intense. And that's the unconscious trying to communicate something to the conscious mind that the conscious mind's not taking into account. But it doesn't have to be night dreams. It can be day dreams. While you're kind of in repose, if your mind goes to a certain state, that's significant.
Tom, let me interrupt a minute because I'm getting an echo. I'm getting a lot of echo from you. Have you changed your position in any way with the phone? Has anything changed on your side of the world there?
Nope.
All right. You're about the same distance from the microphone?
Yep, I'm just on my cell phone.
You're on your cell phone. Yeah, that's probably, cell phones will go in and out like that. I forgot to tell you to use a hard line. they're usually a little bit more consistent. But go ahead. So you do a lot of dream work with folks.
Yeah, people that are open to it. Everyone isn't always open to it. They can be skeptical. But once they start keeping track of them and bring them into sessions, they usually find a lot of meaning by exploring them.
Yeah, I don't do much dream work. It's interesting. I think generally you have to encourage people to do that. And I kind of look for patterns in behavior, and then I kind of work from there and look at, well, you know, how did you ever develop such an outlook? And did this happen? Something happened to you in childhood? And we'll get back and start looking at childhood origins of the ways in which they're harming themselves or their loved ones. And I don't particularly identify it as unconsciousness, and I don't particularly identify it through dream work. But I think all of that's just a matter of personal preference and our own personalities. I think you can get to these things in so many different ways.
Definitely. And to tie it back into what you're talking about with the propensity for hatred and violence in us, I do think it's related to the things that, like we were saying, the things we won't become aware of, make conscious, or accept about ourselves, we're going to project onto other people, and we're going to hate them for having those qualities, which we may also possess.
Yeah, I've even caught myself in therapy over the years where I'm getting surprisingly irritable with my client or patient, and I take a deep breath and contain myself and realize that something inside of me is being touched. Either I had the same whoosh as that person is acting and didn't do it, and so I'm feeling some resentment that they got away with it, or I've actually done something and didn't want to really deal with it. And quite often, I think progress in those situations can be for the therapist to be forgiving toward himself or herself, and that allows us to be more caring and forgiving toward the client. So again, a lot of it starts with ourselves and our own attitudes how we feel, and then we can relate to the client in a way that allows them to be empowered and not to be caught up in the guilt, the shame, the anxiety, and so on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as a therapist, I'm in there as also as a person, as a human being. I'm not just in there as an expert telling them what to do. So Carl Jung had a quote that said, you can't be effective unless you're affected. But I think that we need to be affected by our clients and be aware of it in order to be effective.
I totally agree with you. Now, Jung had what certainly could be called spiritual attitudes. I don't know if Jung actually talk about God or just about these other, you know, varied spiritual issues that he saw. I can't remember if he actually talked about God.
The closest he got he talked about the God image, you know, kind of an archetype without saying God himself. But there's some interviews with him on YouTube, and he was asked, did he believe in God? And he said he doesn't have to believe because he knows. So it's a very interesting interview if you want to check that out.
That is interesting. So, I mean, that is interesting. Yeah, I mean, I can see him sort of getting into some archetypes, but not into to whether there's a being or a presence or a force or something greater than human beings. I can see him waffling around that one, perhaps.
Do you feel? And he also dealt a lot with the problem of evil, which can easily be tied into, again, what we're talking about hatred for other people, thinking that another religion is evil or other people are evil. And he dealt a lot with trying to understand, is there evil in the world, or are these just parts of ourselves that we don't accept, that we call evil?
Yeah. It's hard for me to pass Jung by without not putting you on the spot, but my friend Jeffrey Mason, who wrote a lot about Freud's vulnerabilities, wrote about Jung and his Nazi sympathies, his refusal to ever speak about the Holocaust, his involvement with a journal that was run by Nazis, and then is eventually going to Switzerland, probably for his own safety, but never saying a word from Switzerland about what he knew was going on with the Nazis. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I'm certainly not trying to put you on the spot. It's more just my feeling, like I hate to let Jung go by without bringing up that experience. I don't know if you'd heard anything about that.
No, I mean, I don't know a lot about his personal feelings about Nazism. I guess if he didn't talk about it, then I wouldn't. But I know he got close to meeting Hitler. He was about to meet him right before Hitler was giving a speech, and then something happened. Hitler had to leave, so he didn't get a chance to actually like talk to him. That's kind of the only story I know about him.
Well, that tells you something, that he was actually in a position. I hadn't heard that story. That's very powerful. That he, A, had a desire, and B, was in a position to meet Hitler, tells you something about what his role was in Nazi Germany, what his position was before he left, for reasons we don't know. But that doesn't mean there isn't something that he has to teach people, but it does. It is important information. Do you work on any spiritual level with your clients? Do you ever talk about God or talk about spirituality or ask them about their feelings and thoughts?
I do. It's not always the first question out of my mouth. And the language might be different depending on the client. You know, I might choose different language to bring it up. But I think it's extremely significant how a person thinks of death, what they think is going to happen after they die, and whether or not that they do have a belief that there's something greater than ourselves at work in the universe. So I will bring those issues, which are of ultimate importance, you know, into the session.
Yeah. Well, most people believe in God. Most of us don't have a clear idea, because maybe it's beyond us, but most folks believe in God. And most therapists never raise the issue, never talk about God, as far as I can tell. And I think it's incredibly important, because if you hold that there is a higher power or a creator or a force in the universe, not to pay attention to that as a part of your healing, growing, and getting stronger is to leave out such a huge chunk of your life and what you could be relying upon. So
I think the two things most often left out that are most important are God and sex. Are both very important, but very often left out of counseling. And along the God line is working with people on anxiety and fears, constant phobias. I've been working with people on identifying what do they trust in. And I have a client who believes in God, prays, and trusts. So when he has fear, we're working on since he has that belief, to put his trust into God. Because, like you said, if you profess a belief, then maybe it should have a practical consequence of you being able to feel more secure in your life because you believe that.
Yeah, and I think that most clients are going to be embarrassed to even bring it up because they don't think it kind of fits into the therapy when it's, on some level, the heart of their lives. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that. And, you know, with people who are having their definitively unfair share of misery in life, people who have been horribly abused, people who have faced huge injustices, great losses, threatening illnesses, and so on, finding some not just continued meaning, but special meaning and special purpose in their lives, it makes such a huge difference. And we see this after catastrophes where people, instead of just shutting it out and fleeing from it, you know, center a good portion of their lives around helping people understand catastrophes or helping people do more for children or do more for the elderly or wherever these losses and harms were surrounding. So I think that's another place in which God can fit in, which is there's a sense of purpose for people. And I think that's important for everyone, but it can be life-saving for people who are drowning. I really believe that.
No, and that's another, just the existential perspective, I think, is one of the most therapeutic tools to bring in. Like if you're suffering and you have no reason why, it's crushing. But I think it's Nietzsche that said, if you know, you can endure almost anything if you know the why. And kind of like Viktor Frankl, who went through the Nazi camp and came up with logotherapy, you know, just finding meaning through in your experience makes all the difference.
I have two interesting stories about Frankl. One was I got to see him probably in his very later years back in, I'm not sure when it was. Way back during the Cold War years, sometime after 67 or 8, because that's when I came to Washington, D.C. with the Public Health Service and the National Institute of Mental Health. And he was talking to a very large group of many of them very young people, and somebody asked him, how are we supposed to deal with this threat of atomic war and all the terror and the fear? And he said, by taking responsibility for ourselves. And he actually got booed by a number of people in the audience. And I think that shows the transition this country was going through from the concept of taking responsibility for ourselves, the generation that did that in World War II, and then subsequent generations, which have more and more just wish things would go away and somebody else would handle them. I thought that was interesting. But another interesting thing about Frankel, again, on my negative role today, was that he approved lobotomy in his clinic, thought it helped some patients, and had a very paternal, incredibly paternalistic attitude toward women. I think whenever we look at psychiatrists, they so often have some giant flaws, which you won't necessarily see in when you're starting to look at counselors and therapists who are famous. But psychiatrists, I think, are people who get so involved with power and authority that quite often they're gonna have something terribly wrong in what they're doing, even while they're making a contribution. My thoughts for the day about my profession.
Well, I'm going to say we've got our flaws too. You know,
it's mostly negative. It's mostly not. I think the biggest flaw in the whole counseling area is not taking responsibility for standing up to psychiatry. That to me is the biggest flaw. That brought a dead silence from you. So
I'm just thinking. No, I'm. I mean, I guess that's part of the reason, you know, I wrote this blog post, this article.
Yes.
I did hesitate before doing it. You know, I thought about it, and I was like, you know, am I going to be looked at as, like, I'm anti-DSM, anti-medical model? And maybe so, but it's so important to pathologize our kids, children. Like, we pathologize childhood and come up with all these disorders about these things that are just normal events that any kid's going to go through, any teenager, but now that we want to put a label on it and put a pill in their mouth.
Well, we come full psycho, because, yes, that's what impressed Ginger and what impressed me, that here you were as a counselor taking on these issues, and I just want you to be a model. I just, this has got to happen. Counselors, social workers, psychologists, marriage and family therapists, you all got to, if necessary, band together. One way to band together is join our organization, but that's not what was on our mind. But that's the goal of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, is to bring people together around these two principles. One, a critique of this biological drug model, and two, the promotion of caring, empowering approaches to human beings in therapy and education and in life. Again, a pitch for, we're getting down to the end here, and April 26th or 28th, it is not too late to go to empathictherapy.org and sign up. Tom, 30 seconds, a few parting thoughts?
Yeah, I guess along those lines, my hope is that in the future, the medication of kids for ADHD and bipolar will be looked back upon as an archaic treatment technique, similar to, like, electroshock.
Man, we just got to get people to know that electroshock's an archaic treatment. I am with you 100%. Thank you for being on the show. We've been talking with Tom Feuer, F-E-W-E-R, Thomas. He's from the New Orleans Counseling Center, a genuine counselor with the courage to stand by his convictions. Thank you very much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.